What's happening?
What's up, Rob?
You look like you've either been on lying on the beach or you've been more likely on the golf course.
I've been on the golf course.
I knew it! Welcome to Literally with Rob Lowe. And thank you all for the support of the show. It's just been going great. And the only reason it's going great is because you're listening. So thank you in advance for the support. Today is a really good one. I'm just going to warn you, it's good. So pull up a chair, pull over to the side of the road. This is a really unexpectedly different talk with somebody who I've just been a fan of forever because he's a groundbreaker in his field. He's hilarious. And you know I love funny people if you've been listening to the podcast. But funny and thoughtful are a really, really rare combination. And you're going to hear stories about this man's life that are just beyond belief. So I'm really happy to share with you my inspiring and funny talk with George Lopez. What's your handicap? What are you playing to these days?
I think it's about a good 11.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I've been playing since 81 and I used to say, like, I don't play for the score. I play for the temperament because I had a really bad temperament growing up. But it helped me kind of rewire myself where I wouldn't, you know, throw things or wouldn't let it affect the next shot. And that's a huge part of what I think helped me in business because, we come from a culture where if two people got in a fight, they might not ever talk again in their whole life.
Mm-hmm.
They might be too proud to say, hey, man, you know, I was wrong or, you know, can I talk to you for a second? You know, that fight we got into, I don't know if you realized you hurt me when you said this. None of that happened. Those people would just ignore each other for maybe the rest of their lives. So I didn't want to do that. And I saw that growing up, where people just kind of remove people from their lives. And in golf, it was so difficult for me to get a hold of, so foreign a game that I liked it. And all of the traits that I think, you know, either my baseball coach told me was wrong with me or my little league coach told me was wrong with me, all kind of came together when I started to play golf. I quit, I cheated. You'd say, what'd you take on that all? I had a six. You had a six. Let me see. And really, when you realize that you're only cheating yourself, you start to realize that the score isn't important, but like the rules of golf, the integrity, not moving the ball, not, you know, looking to see around if anybody's around, rolling it over and stuff like that. And I had a lot of those things early on. But we were always trying to get by on people. And golf completely, completely eliminated that from my life.
That's amazing. It's such a great articulation of, I think, why the game becomes an obsession for people. Because a lot of people, probably right now, as they're listening to this podcast, are hitting the forward button. I hate golf. And when are they going to talk about the George Lopez show? That was my favorite show in the world. What are these guys doing?
Yeah.
Let's move on to things. But that's such a great articulation of it because that's why we love it. That's exactly why we love it. And
going to the George Lopez show, when I heard about other comedians, I was almost the last comedian to get a shot. And all you really wanted was a shot. You know, everybody says like, you know, whether it's a boxer, whether it's an actor, you know, I just yep. want a shot. You know,
yep.
guy would say, I never did this. Even they made movies. I never fought. I could have been a contender. But I saw guys go in the machine and out of the machine in a span of like 2 months and then never get back to that level again. You know, I played golf with a friend of mine who was so naive that when things started to happen for him, he wasn't prepared for either the change that show business brings, the almost like deceit of people who are kind of working behind you. So maybe they might say, hey, maybe this guy's not as good an actor as we thought he might be. You know, sometimes comedians can't act. Who's going to tell him he's going to get? And he just kind of got in and got spit out and never got back to that level. So by the time that I got to have an opportunity because of, I think, because of golf. I wanted to fight everybody. And then I had a producer that said, hey, man, listen, man, you know, you need to, you know, relax. And then if there's an issue, I'll tell you if you should get upset, or I'll tell you not to worry about something. And instead of, you know, it driving me crazy, I kept like a very calm demeanor, and I just did my work, and I didn't feel like everybody was out to get me, and I didn't feel like we ever had a problem that couldn't be resolved, and I never felt like I was either lucky to be there, or I didn't think like I didn't deserve it. I'd done my work, just like somebody preparing for anything. And I think golf, you hit balls and you go and you keep going by yourself. And, you know, I rode all the time at home, and I went to the clubs all the time. I didn't hang around the club like a lot of guys did. I thought that kind of diminished your impact if a guy went and did his set, but then hung around 3 hours or waited for people to walk out and say, hey, man, you were great. I was in and I was out. And I think all of those things prepared me for something that I never even thought I would have an opportunity to do. So when I did it, I wasn't overwhelmed by it.
When you were when you were coming up in that era, and as you said, people got their shot. Like, what would the first shot would be? What, you're going on Carson? Would that be like the first? Like, walk me through how you end up going, getting to the point where they go, "Hey, man, we want to build a show around."
So first of all,
that's the shot of shots.
Yeah. Johnny Carson was around all of those years. As a matter of fact, growing up, you know, being an only child, you would see you'd see Bill Cosby there. Burt Reynolds was a great storyteller there.
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Yes.
Oh, he was like, he would come back from commercial and everybody would be laughing. And Johnny Carson would say, Burt Reynolds is telling some off-color jokes to the audience, but it was kind of legendary.
Oh, yeah.
So you see all of those things, and without, you know, I mean, social media and all those other distractions, that's what everybody was watching. So to see all of that, to see the star, to see Johnny Carson, to know that for a comedian, that was, you know, the high mark. Eddie Murphy did it, Leno, Letterman, Jimmy Walker, all of the guys. Drew Carey did it. Drew Carey was living in his car. He got a chance to do the Tonight Show. He was incredible and so, you know, so innocent and funny and unassuming, and he couldn't believe it. So after he's done, he's standing there, and Johnny Carson is waving him over, which is like the best thing that can ever happen. And Drew's like, me? And he's like, come over. And he was just so sweet that the next day he was a huge star.
Literally, in those days, because in those days, TV was such, the ratings were such, and the people who were watching, that it literally overnight, you were a star, legitimately overnight.
Yeah. So he had a deal. He started to do a show, started to work at, you know, Warner Brothers on a show. He sold it to ABC. And all of a sudden, you know, you're so proud of this guy. And you're like, man, that guy's like one of us. But not all of us get that opportunity. So I remember that I was working at the Maxim Hotel in the Playboy Girls of Rock and Roll in 1988.
And it sounds like the best job. That sounds like what you worked your whole life for. Said, to me, like, I would go on Carson hoping I get that job.
I mean, that's right. So there's nudity, then there's for 7 minutes, and then there's more nudity, and then there's another comedian, then everybody who was nude comes back on stage for one last number, and the show's over.
It's amazing. That's, to me, that would have been the shot. I would have been like, I've made it. I don't need to do anything more.
So in that, I remember I was looking at the life section of USA Today, and Johnny Carson had announced his retirement, and it said that there would be six more people that would be on the show between July of 90 and May of 91 when he was going to retire.
Yep, I remember. Yeah,
big news. It becomes like Willy Wonka. You know, there's six tickets. Six new guys, and I'm not thinking I'm in a hotel in Las Vegas, and I'm not thinking I'm going to be that guy, because I was kind of what I never wanted to be was a guy who only could make money on the road. So as I read that, I thought, wow, man, that's, you know, it's amazing. It's like Willy Wonka. So somehow I get back in L.A. and Jerry Seinfeld's manager, Shapiro West, Shapiro and Howard West, Seinfeld was on, and they saw me and they were kind of interested in me. And then the guy, Jim McCauley from The Tonight Show, was there. And then as I was showcasing, McCauley says to, George, are you representing this kid? And he's like, yeah, we're thinking about it. Well, if you do, tell him, you know, I think it's interesting. He should prepare some stuff and give us a call. So when I got off, they said, hey, we got you The Tonight Show. They did. They were just standing next to the guy from The Tonight Show. But then I spent a week working on...
By the way, let me just pause you right there. For people who are not in show business, you just heard great show business distilled down to the perfect story. The guy from The Tonight Show says he should prepare something. We'll be interested. The people in showbiz tell George he's got The Tonight Show.
Right. And they had that's nothing to do with it. All they were doing was standing next to the guy from The Tonight Show.
That's show business in a nutshell. Continue. This story is amazing.
So I go, I prepare for a week, 10 hours a day. I'd fall asleep with the notes on my chest. I'd wake up, I'd keep writing. So I go to McCauley's office and it's there on Burbank, right across the street from Der Wiener Schnitzel in Burbank.
Where all the great art happens. Yes, of course. Right near Der Wiener Schnitzel. Yes.
Johnny Carson did that. So I literally go to the guy's office and it's like me and you right now. And he's standing behind the desk and he goes, okay, let's see what you got. And I'm by myself. And I just start talking with this material that I presented. And he doesn't laugh. He's just sitting there. And at the end he goes, okay, the beginning, I don't like the beginning, but move the middle to the front and then move the ending story to the middle and then find an ending. And, do it for a week and come back. So I went back to this place on Barham that I was living, worked on it again. And by chance, I was at the improv like a week later. And he walks in and walks over to me and he says, hey, are you going to do any of the stuff that I'd asked you to do? And I said, yeah, I can do it. You know, I'll do it. So it's one of those, you know, night rub that the audience is a little bit higher. They're a little bit more energetic. I go up there and, I catch it. You know, I catch 7 minutes of it. And when I walk off, he follows me into the hallway. He sticks out his hand. He goes, hey, man, congratulations. You know, you got The Tonight Show. I was like, wow.
Holy I got the crap. Show.
So then I get bumped by Bill Cosby. It's November of 91. I get bumped by Bill Cosby. And usually, you know, they said, hey, man, you got bumped. And then.
And by the way, what that means for the showbiz people is like you would go there. But if you were not maybe quite at a particular level of fame, there was always that chance that the show ran long. You weren't going to be on it. You're bumped. Mm-hmm. So when big dog Bill Cosby comes on and you're just brand new George Lopez, you know, you're in danger.
Yeah. So now every comedian said, man, I got bumped and I never got on. And then, you know, I was going to go on and I got bumped and I never got on. So I was like, man, it's not going to happen. So 2 days later, they call me again. They go, hey, you got next week. So it's Bob Newhart, myself, and Lisa Stansfield, who had that song, Been Around the World.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Yep. So it's us three. I go over there. I do The Tonight Show with Bob Newhart, and who's, you know, 90 at that time. And I mean, so you're just like, wow. And Lisa was hot. I was hot. Johnny was, and I did it, man. And Johnny, you know, at that time, I think he was getting death threats. So he was being followed by the Burbank police. So in the hallway after the show,
who wants to kill Johnny Carson other than Jay Leno? I mean, obviously we know Jay tried to kill him for years. We know that.
Yeah, that's a great one. So two Burbank police come around the corner, and then here comes this little man in these Zachary Hall suits, you know, polyester. I mean, clearly polyester with the pockets, with the flaps over the pockets. And it's Johnny, and they say, clear the hall. But then I go stand in the doorway because I was just on the show, so I'm like, I'm in the doorway. So the two cops come by. Here comes Johnny Carson. He's tiny. He's older. And then two other police behind him. And he stops at my doorway there, and he extends his hand. He says, hey, young man, did a nice job. Jim was telling me about you. It's nice to have you on the show. And, you know, maybe you can come back on before I leave again. But I enjoyed having you on. And I was just like, I couldn't believe it, you know?
Wow. That's...
And he had these liver spots, Rob. You know, I looked at his hand. He had these liver spots on his hand. I mean, imagine looking at Johnny Carson like as close as you and I, you know, just like a foot and a half away. He had these liver spots on his forehead, and he had the little comb over. And I was just like, I'm taking in every line and every liver spot on Johnny Carson's face because, you know, that's the only other time I saw him. But, you know, it's kind of an amazing.
And it's a good lesson for other celebrities who may be listening to the podcast. Like when you meet your fans, they're looking at your liver spots. Do you know what I mean? They may be telling you they love the West Wing or the George Lopez show. What they're really doing is counting the liver spots. And that's...
Well, you know, you've always been a very attractive person. So I go to Houston and I land in Houston and the driver says, as we're at the red light, the driver says, this place across the street has the most incredible barbecue. My show's on. We're doing a concert in Houston. I go, let's go in there. I go in there. As I get to the cash register, the woman says to me, hey, you're on TV. I say, yes, I am. And she looks at me and she goes, wow, you look different. You should stay on TV. That's what she said.
You should stay on TV. You
should stay on TV.
Oh, my God.
I said, wow, man.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
There's so much of that stuff that, I mean, I think you're great at what you do, but there's so much of that stuff that you live with every day. And it's things you can't believe that, there's not only things that you can't believe happened in your career, but there's things you can't believe that people would say to somebody never having ever seen them before.
Oh, for sure. My friend David Crosby has a philosophy on that. And, you know, David feels like, you know, and David's been an icon, a musical icon since 65, whatever, and still is, you know, and he has a philosophy, and he also looks very specific. I mean, like, there's no, like, you know, when you've seen David Crosby.
Right, yeah.
And his thing is that he feels like when he shows up in people's lives, that it short circuits their, actually short circuits their reality because I've existed in a two-dimensional form, either with the music or a photo or an interview. It's two-dimensional, and now I'm three-dimensional, and I'm in front of somebody, and their reality is so challenged that they'll say anything. And
right.
It'd be great to do a book of quotes of like that, of you should stay on television. By the way, maybe you and I should just do that book. That's a great title. You should stay on television.
I think we know a lot of the same people, yeah. You know, it's interesting because of, you know, I spent a lot of time alone. I grew up in San Fernando, Mission Hills. I didn't know my biological father. My mother was not healthy, and my grandfather wasn't biological. My grandmother was. My grandmother was kind of tough on me, but they worked all the time. And it's almost like, you know, there's no reason why a kid who spent so much time alone would ever succeed at anything. I mean, I don't think anybody expected anything from me. But in watching TV and in watching those things and in not having either family or not having a male figure, you know, when I started to play golf on a dare, those clubs and my temperament and the cheating and the leaving and the quitting almost became a surrogate family. And, you know, if I hadn't have played golf, if I hadn't have, you know, learned those hard lessons, I'm not sure that I would be where I am. You know, I always felt different from the guys that I grew up with. Not better. I just felt different. And you know, I've told a story that a baseball coach gave, you know, he bought some equipment at San Fernando High and he gave us these booklets of car wash tickets to sell. But I didn't sell any because I wasn't a salesman. I was getting introverted. And then he says, you owe me, you know, $300. And I go, for what? For the tickets. I said, I didn't sell any. He goes, well, you know, you're responsible because, you know, this equipment's not going to pay for itself. So he and I got into a big fight, and he was the first guy really to get into my face and say that I was a quitter and that I wasn't connected to anything or devoted to anything. And when something got tough, that I was going to pack it in. And it wasn't until, you know, at El Carrizo in Sylmar that I quit. When I was playing golf, I was leaving. These guys go, "Where are you going?" "Oh, I'm leaving, man. I got something to do." I was, you know, just frustrated that that guy's voice rang in my head. And it's one of those things that it just rings in your head. I heard it. And, you know, I went to the school maybe 4 years after I graduated and waited for all the players to leave and walked up to them and apologized to them and said, "Hey, man, I'm sorry the way I treated you when I was here. You know, you were right." And he's like, "That's what you came to tell me?" And I had never, ever, ever apologized. I mean, I opened with, talked about it, yeah, removing people from your life. And I had never apologized to a man for the way that I behaved. And I don't think that I could have gone a day knowing that he taught me those lessons and not going back and thanking him for teaching me those lessons.
It's, it's funny hearing you talk. You've done so much work on yourself, and it seems to me like you've done it in a way that's really, really, really interesting. Like as you were coming up, my guess is you didn't have the time or the money to do proper therapy. So you took the mentorship where you could find it, is what I'm kind of getting.
Right. And it's almost like, you know, the unfortunate part now is, you know, I'm 59 and you think that, you know, when you're growing up, and then I was still doing stand-up in high school. I started right before we graduated. And then in your 20s, you're doing these clubs and you're gone. I started to travel on the road. And then I got married in my early 30s. And even that was a little bit of a double life thing. And then when I started to do my show in the 2000s, again, it's another part of your life. You're locked away. So the relationship part of my life at 59 has never developed, or the connection to somebody, because everything that I chose to do, I could do by myself. I could go on the road by myself. I could golf by myself. And then when I started to get involved in relationships, since I didn't see healthy relationships, I couldn't connect to somebody because I just didn't know how. Those tools, I never had those tools.
When I relate so much, you know, and then there's the other element to it that people will say that at whatever age you are, when you become famous, if you become famous, you're frozen in time at that age.
Yeah.
Like, and which would make me a permanent 18-year-old. That's not good in a 57-year-old's body.
No.
Right? Not. And it's true. What we... And the reason you're such an inspiration and a survivor is that you have this kind of insight. And I'm just frankly blown away that you've done it with this sort of ad hoc put together,
right,
with your own thinking and the people that have come across your transom, whether it's the baseball coach or what you've learned from golf. You've synthesized it in such an amazing way from, like, you know, I've been lucky that I've had really good gurus that I've had the access and the knowledge to seek out, you know, in my journey, you know, which is very different and yet also very similar. I always felt different than when I was a little kid, mm-hmm, always. And it was shy, which people were like, "Wait, you're an actor, you're a comedian. What do you mean you're shy, George Lopez? You're hilarious." It's like, no, I'm shy. Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and same.
And even feeling different doesn't mean you felt better. Like all the guys, I'm still friends with all the guys I went to high school with, and I didn't feel better than them. And even though they had fathers and they had mothers and, you know, their parents would come and, you know, watch them play baseball. I love baseball. And I mean, my grandmother raised me. My grandmother was tough. And, you know, one of the saddest, funniest things is, you know, so when you have 12 games in Little League and there's, you know, 12 players or 14 players, every week, one of the players' mothers is responsible for being the snack mom. And after practice, they either bring juice or chips.
Oh, I remember.
Or something for the team.
Oh, yeah.
And my I played baseball all those years, and my grandmother never did. And I would be like, hey, grandma, you know, in 2 weeks, you're the snack. What's that that you have to bring? Why would I go to the store and get things for you to take for your friends? Because that's what everybody does. Although, sorry, that's what everybody's at. That's why I got to do it. So it embarrassed me to be the only kid that would leave the kids hanging, and they'd go for all of those years. And she never thought twice about it, but it embarrassed me all those years, you know.
I totally 100% get it. And it's funny how those things are huge. And yet as a kid, you go, well, I mean, you know, my grandmother is a different generation, and you like you try to, so you can survive it.
Yeah.
You try to justify it, right?
Yeah.
And then, but as when you become an adult and you try to grow and you try to figure out why you are the way you are, you look back on it and go, no, that's really fucking radical.
Right. Right.
Right.
So when you see kids now, and there's so much, and you know, there's therapy, and then there's trauma therapy, and then there's, you know, kids that don't go outside or whatever. Like, you could sound like you're 1,000 years old, but the unfortunate thing for these kids is that I don't think that there's whatever ignited in me the spark of wanting to do stand up at 11, starting to write jokes on, you know, old gas envelopes or anything I could find, and then never telling anybody my dreams. And then June 4th of 79, I graduated the 11th of June in 79, going to the Comedy Store in Westwood, a kid that was afraid that couldn't, you know, hand out papers in class because I just felt like everybody was looking at me, to go do something that I wasn't good at for years and years and years, and to continue to go back. To me, of all the things that I've done, the thing that I cannot explain is why somebody would go back all those years and be bad and be bad and be bad. And then the third time I was good by accident, and it was like the first time ever feeling this love, this applause, this thing. I was standing on the stage, and it was almost like if it gave you new blood, like the blood that you had, nobody believed in. Now you have this new blood where you felt like it could be a possibility. And you know, I didn't know I was going to do that good. I didn't expect to be put up earlier than I was, but it just happened. And I think, you know, even having a daughter that's 24 that said to me, you know, I thought I would be further ahead. And I said, further ahead of what? Like, of what? Of what I want to do. But she hadn't focused on what she wants to do. But the idea that somebody would say, I thought it'd be further ahead. Again, I think for kids, you don't need, you know, all of these things to be inspired. You have to find it within yourself.
Well, that's also a connection that we both have, is you started writing. You have no idea why you started writing jokes at 11, did you say? Mm-hmm. People don't do that.
No.
They don't do that. So it's like, why did I, in Dayton, Ohio, not exactly a hotbed of show business, decide at 8 years old I was going to be an actor?
Right.
No idea. No idea.
And how did that happen? Was that in school, or was that...
No, I my parents took me to a community theater, the Dayton Community Theater. It's still there. It's in a different building, but it's still there. And it was, I guess they had a friend who was in the play, and it was Oliver, and there's little kids in it, the little whatever ragamuffins or whatever the hell they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like struck by lightning. It was like a bad moment in a movie where I was like, that right there. Mm-hmm. And we were walking out of the lobby, and there was a little like a poster for summer acting workshop for kids. And I asked my parents, I read it and was like, I want to do that. Will you sign me up? And they were like, yeah, sure. But, you know, in their mind, I'm sure it was like, if it wasn't that, it'd be, you know, summer camp or something else. But right. For me, it was like, this is the beginning of where I'm going to go. And I knew it in my bones, in my DNA, and no one could tell me otherwise. And it makes no sense. An 8-year-old should not know that, care about that. And it was about, you know, a blessing, but it's also a curse in a weird way, because now I have kids like you. What made me think of this is your 24-year-old. And you and I had the blessing curse of knowing what we wanted to do.
Right.
These kids don't know. And by the way, most people don't know. You know, they think about, they kind of have an interest in this area of life, and maybe they'll try that as a job, and they don't. But to have, it was hard for me as a father to offer advice when I knew what I wanted to do, and, you know, the kids are exploring. I just don't have any experience with that. Did you ever have that?
No. I mean, you know, the gap year is an incredible thing to me. The fact that somebody would get out of school and say, you know, I'm going to take a gap year of doing this, you know, and when you tell your kids that, it's like, you know, just leave me alone, you know, I'll figure it out. But time goes by so fast that, you know, you're wasting something that is so valuable when I don't think they're devoting their true attention to it. Either you feel it or not. Like, you saw that when you were 8,
yeah.
When I was 11, you know, and when that, you know, when the coach told me that I was a quitter, and in 1984, you know, I'd lost my job, and I woke up and I was sleeping on my man's, you know, in a duplex on his couch, and it was a Monday, and I was kind of on and off of stand-up, doing a little bit. I remember it was Ali was fighting, and Ali would fight and then come back. He wasn't sure he was going to fight. And then I thought, you know, Ali, you know, so I thought as a quitter and as a guy who getting that information from that coach that morning at 6:15 in the morning on a duplex in Pacoima, and I didn't have a job, and I just woke up and I said, well, you know, what the fuck am I going to do for my life? You know, am I going to get another job? And I had already done stand-up, and I thought, well, what would I do for free? And I thought, you know, I'd do stand-up for free. So that night, that day, I prepared whatever material was left over from, you know, the 6 months before, the year before. And I said to myself that morning, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do stand-up, and I'm not going to quit, and I don't care what happens, but I'm not quitting. And that was the first time I did that. And when I went back, guys made fun of me, like, hey, look who's here. You know, he didn't see me in a year, I hadn't seen him in 6 months. And I just kept going, and I kept going, and I kept going. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And I just kept going. And I never thought of success, but I never thought of success, but more importantly, I never thought of quitting.
Well, you know what's amazing, George, is like, it's one thing to give a bad performance or not do well on a TV show or whatever, because you don't really know. You might read the reviews, but there's no live audience. But to be a comedian and to not do well, that's got to be painful. When you say not do well, you're talking about you tell a joke and it's silent.
Okay, eating it. Just eating it. You eat it for years, you know. There used to be a place called the Natural Fudge in Hollywood. And it was like the first, it was just in a rundown area over there at this kind of behind KTTV, that old back over at Van Ness thing.
Yes.
It's called the Natural Fudge. And it was just this little building. It was a Sprouts, and I'm looked at this. They made you buy food if you were going to perform.
Oh God!
And
Jesus,
I may have done the worst one. I've done worse since then, but maybe the worst ever. And I got in my car and I was driving down the 170, right by Roscoe, and I started to cry. And I'm like, well, you know, I'm driving, I'm crying. I'm like, you know what, man? Fuck this, man. I don't need this shit. It didn't come easy. I'm like, I don't need this bullshit. And I remember just, you know, wiping my eyes and getting closer to my off ramp and getting off and, you know, waking up in the morning and saying, no, I'm going back. I mean, but that night, that 7 miles was maybe one of the most difficult personal behind the wheel, just frustrated. I don't need this shit. I'm quitting. Fuck it. I'm no good. And in the morning, you know, I wasn't better. I wasn't funnier in the morning, but I just got up and I did it again, man.
You know what I love about having this talk with you is I would never, ever have suspected that this was your journey. ever. And you know, and it's like, it's that old thing of like, we look at other people and I'm like, you're fucking George Lopez, dude. You're a legend. You're a trailblazer. You're a legend. You're hilarious. You've been on the scene forever. And you, I would look back, I would just assume and do the math in my head, knowing nothing, that, you know, sure, it was what it was, but you don't, like, people don't realize what other people's journeys are. And it doesn't matter if you're, right, you know, like George Lopez or me or whoever, people listening, it's like, we it's just a great reminder that we don't know the suffering or the journeys that people have been on. And a lot of times we assume that people have had it easy because they've been successful, and you just don't know, man. I would never have known that this is your story. It's really, 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 really inspiring and good to hear.
So what I tell people is, and I'm not an advice giver, but if I see somebody that say, man, if you ever wanted to do something, do it. It's never too late to do it. You know, don't tell anybody your dreams. Don't tell anybody what you want to do. Just inspire yourself. Like, if you can't inspire yourself, you know, looking for somebody to inspire you, or looking for somebody for advice. You know, my wife, my ex-wife, God bless her. So, you know, in 2005, you know, the Emmys were kind of not doing very well. And then they decide, I think in 2005, that they were going to have like different comedians be hosts, you know, guest hosts. So I think it was myself, Brad Garrett, Ray Romano, Conan O'Brien, Bernie Mac, maybe Sarah Silverman. And we all presented, Shanley, all presented things at different times. So that was on a Sunday, and I went to rehearsal that Saturday. I was preparing my stuff, and my wife found my notes, you know, and she's looking at my notes, and she looks at me and she says, "You're not going to do this shit, are you? This is the shit you're going to, this is the shit you're going to do."
No. And
I said, "Yeah, that's the shit I'm going to do." She goes, first of all, it's not funny and it's racist. And I said, "It's not funny, it's racist." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you let me worry about it? Why don't you, you know?" So we get in a fight that morning. I go to rehearsal. I do it. It's not even in the back of my head. Like, you know, I'm not going to let her destroy, you know, what I'm, that's me. Like, I'm working on me. That's why in the beginning I said I'd never let anybody, look at my stuff or ask somebody. So I do it. And she has this face like, you know, I think you're making a big mistake. And I'm just like, you know what? If it is, it's my mistake.
Right.
So sure. The Sopranos are there, 6 Feet Under. Everybody Loves Raymond. It's a great time in TV.
Yes. Yes,
so
it was.
So we're sitting next to each other and they come and get you. The escort come and gets you. And I stand up and she stands up and I said, you know what? You stay here. And she goes, "What? I'm going with you." I said, "You stay here." I said to her, "You burned your backstage pass yesterday. So do me a favor and stay here." Right? So I go out there and I presented the first Emmy for reality TV.
That's all your fault. God damn it.
It was the first. It is my fault. So they gave me the first Emmy. So I said, I went out there and said, you know, Survivor, people on an island. I said, you know, let's let them go to East LA and see how long they last. You know, would they last a season? And then I had a joke about Big Brother. And I said, you know, 14 people living in a house. I said, it's been done. So everybody, at that point, everybody's fucking rolling. Like, the whole place is rolling. And then I said, you know, Extreme Makeover, where they take somebody who's unattractive and in an hour they're beautiful. I said, but isn't that what a 12-pack does?
Oh, killer.
You know, so
killer them. Jokes. Killer, killer, killer.
Killed them. So the next day, the LA Times says that I'm like a Latino Will Rogers, and they have that quote.
Oh, yes.
14 people in a house, it's been done, it says George Lopez. And the guy that wrote it said, this guy is just like, you know, he's just cultural, he does this thing. It's in the paper. We go back there. And again, like, she didn't believe, didn't think. And it was a success. Everybody did great. And I did great. But I didn't let that person get to me. I didn't let them think. So, you know, my thing was never to show anybody my cards, and I would play my cards myself.
Well, it's so smart because I've been married forever to my wife, and the one place I know that I cannot trust her is comedy and what I'm going to say publicly. And I think because they're scared we're going to bomb.
Right.
You know, they're scared we're going to not do it because they love us. But I cannot tell you how many times I've had that. You're not going to say that, are you? Right. Thing that you, but that you had the balls to go out and do it. I remember I was at that Emmys. I remember it now. You crushed it. I remember that joke. I mean, that joke was huge. By the way, it's such a well-constructed 14 people in house. It's been done.
Been done.
That's a lot of TNT in two sentences. And we'll be right back after this.
But also, you know, I got discovered by Sandra Bullock. Sandra Bullock was really the first person to see me and take an interest in me. And
I didn't know Sandra Bullock was a talent scout. I need to know more about this. How did this happen?
So, you know, so her mother passes away in the early 2000s. She's very disillusioned with the business, and she had just done Miss Congeniality. She's like the biggest star, Sandra Bullock. And somebody asked her, you know, a person that she was working with to come and see me. And she came to see me, and she had an idea for a show that was more centrally about teenagers. And I remember backstage, she said, you know, after seeing you, your life is like a train wreck. Your comedy is like a train wreck. You can't turn away from. And I want to, you know, have a meeting with you. I want you to come and talk to me about what your family's like. And I remember I was at Whitsitt hitting golf balls. The meeting was at 2 o'clock at Fortis over there, right off of by the old Tower Records on Sunset.
Yeah.
And at 1 o'clock, I'm hitting golf balls, and my manager calls me and he says, "Are you on your way?" And I said, "No, man, I'm not. You know, I'm over here hitting golf balls." "What the fuck are you doing? You know, they're waiting for you." I said to him, "Hey, man, you know, what's she going to do for me? I mean, what is she going to do for me?" She goes, "Hey, listen, she wants you to see you. She's already saw you. She's interested in you." I said, "But what is she going to do for me? You know, just a defeatist, you know, kind of a defeatist attitude, maybe a little bit of afraid, but also, you know, really, what was she going to do for me?" So he says, "Go over there." So I remember I left all these golf balls. I told the guy next to me, "Hey, get out of these balls." And I went over there and we talked for maybe, you know, 3 hours, and we had lunch, and she kind of got it, you know, and she kind of got the idea of the show around a guy who didn't have a father, who had a mother that was overbearing, and his wife expected him to be a better husband, but his mom still treated him like a boy. That's what we decided. You know. And I remember the Chicago Bulls were winning all these championships, and Phil too, they won with the triangle.
Yeah.
So I thought to myself, this show is going to be like a triangle. Like, I'm going to be the triangle between my mom and my wife. I'm going to be the triangle before how I raise my kids and how my wife thinks I can raise the kids. And in that triangle, I found some success. So as she was walking me down the stairs and she opens the door, you know, I look at her and I said, "Listen, you know, I don't know what's going to happen here. And, you know, this is something that's never been done successfully on TV. So if I don't ever get a chance to see you again, or if I, you know, I just want to say, you know, thank you for taking an interest in me." You know, and she looked at me and she said, why don't you worry about being funny? And why don't you let me worry about all of that?" And it really was the first time at 41 that anybody ever really had my back, and it was somebody that wasn't related to me.
That's so great. That's really inspiring story. And that does not happen all the time.
No, it doesn't happen. And I remember when we were living in Sherman Oaks, and Drew Carey's show had syndicated, and it syndicated for like a huge amount. That's when, you know, those guys were making huge amounts of money.
Bazillions.
Fuck it. Roseanne made, you know, $250 million and Drew Carey had syndicated for like $100 million. They made $100 million each.
Yep.
And I remember, you know, I'm in the kitchen there in this like nook, and she just opens a paper and she says, "You know how much money Drew Carey made last year?" And I said, "No." She goes, "He made $40 million. And I was just, you know, I got up, I got some golf balls from my garage, and I was hitting some golf balls in the dark. And my neighbor across the street, Jan, you know, she saw me hitting golf balls. She walks across the street. She goes, "What the fuck are you doing?" I look at her. I go, "You know how much Drew Carey made last year?" I said, $40 million. And she comes over and she looks at me and she goes, you know, my man, fuck Drew Carey. Like, you're George Lopez. And I wasn't doing anything. Like, you know, listen, do yourself a favor and don't worry about what Drew Carey's doing. Don't worry about what anybody's doing. You're a funny dude. Like, just keep doing your thing, not knowing anything about what was down the line. She was just telling me pretty much, don't worry about anybody else and just be your own person. And the guy that did Drew Carey's show ended up doing my show.
Wow.
And with Sandra. And it's wild, Rob. I never, you know, these things that have all happened, man, that, you know, I remember seeing the end of Drew Carey's show and it said created by Bruce Elford and Drew Carey. And I would look at my wife and I go, you know, where's my Bruce Elford? Like, when am I going to get a shot? And we were at the in Pasadena at that big hotel. They used to do the
Ritz-Carlton,
the TCAs, the Ritz-Carlton.
Yep, absolutely.
So we're up on this floor and everybody's outside and Sandra's in one room and you can see her in a little TV in the hallway. You know, she's in talking about me. And then we go to the next one and Bruce is in there. And I look at my wife and he's in this little TV screen. And I go, hey, there's my Bruce Elford right there. And he's in there talking about me and talking about the show. Crazy shit, man. Wow.
It's
crazy. You don't ever imagine. I mean, like, I never imagined it. You can't either control it, but also there's success and there's failure. Like, it could have not worked.
And timing plays a huge part in everybody's lives. No matter what they're doing, what whether in show business or not in show business, timing is a really, really, really big thing.
Timing is a big thing. But fear also, you know, fear intimidates people and maybe they may not share with anybody, but, you know, timing can't have its place if fear keeps you from even getting in the game. You know, so I was never, I got to that point in the 90s where I just thought, since I was afraid of everything growing up and I was afraid of, you know, stand up, I really kind of analytically said, like, what am I afraid of? I mean, am I afraid of going up there and nobody laughing? I mean, that kind of happens to everybody. So if that is the worst thing that can happen to me, well, let me just work as hard as I can work to avoid that happening, which I didn't have in the 80s. I kind of found that in the 90s. And once I stopped worrying about what other people were doing and started to just work on myself, it just, everything changed.
Who is the funniest person you ever saw?
In a club, in a theater?
Yeah, in a club, like where you saw them and they were just electric. Like, you just could not believe how they were in that moment.
So in 1987 at the Ice House in Pasadena, before Dana Carvey was on Saturday Night Live, this guy was the most incredible comedian I ever saw. The church lady, the character from Wayne's World was in there. He did Scarface. He did all of the characters that you ever saw in his movies were in his act. And he was only there two nights because he was doing Wise Guys with Burt Lancaster and Kurt Russell. Kurt Douglas.
Yeah.
Douglas. And he could only work 2 days. And I remember the second day he came, he got five standing ovations, five encores the first night. And then I remember when he showed up the second night, I asked him a simple question. I said, hey, man, how did you get so funny? Like, how does this happen? And he says, you know what, George, it's all attitude, bro. This is like, if you believe it, they'll believe it. And I never walked up there and say, hey, but how about a round of applause for Rob? Wasn't he great? He goes, I get to the business. Like, I walk up there, I get to the business. I don't ask them how they're doing. I tell them how I'm doing. And I just drive, you know, I'm the driver. And for a little guy like that, and you saw him work, it's true. And maybe one of the most valuable lessons that I took advice. I didn't know somebody would say, like, what the fuck does that mean? I took that advice. I took every advice that I thought was real. And here's a guy that was the funniest person I ever saw. I took that advice. That put me on the right path too.
By the way, that is such a great piece of advice for everybody. Like, if you have, like, the opening gambit of, how you doing tonight? I love that that's fucked. Yeah. You tell them how you're doing. It's like, it's so good. And you know, it's funny because I agree with you that I think of all, and I've been blessed to work with a bunch of funny people from, you know, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Ricky Gervais, Gary Shandling, you name it. I've been really, Mike Myers, Dan, all of them, the murderer, the killer, the assassin,
right.
It's Dana.
Yes.
He's just, when you look, see, I did live scenes with him, okay, on Saturday Night Live.
Yep.
And in Wayne's World. And when you looked in his eyes, you felt like you were on stage with a wild animal.
Mm-hmm.
Like he would murder you
mm-hmm.
for a laugh.
Yep.
And not in a bad way. It's like you talk about the eye of the tiger. No one has the comedic eye of the tiger. Like, he's a fucking killer. Like, his appearances on Carson, he used to do a bit where all he did was, you know, those stupid cups of water they put in front of you when you're on a talk show? Those mugs.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I think in the old days didn't have water in them, but with my luck, I came up late and they just have water in them. But Dana's bit was he would just drink from the fucking cup and go, it was so good. And it just destroyed. He's mm-hmm. he's the best. I think that's a great choice.
Did and also he was a guy that could do an hour and make it seem the most effortless performance you'd ever seen anybody do. You know, I did a thing with him up in the Bay Area for Tony La Russa's dog rescue thing, and Dana was up there, and he did an hour, and it was the most effortless hour I've ever seen anyone do. Like, that guy was, he's just, I don't think he gets enough credit as, you know, maybe as one of the top comedians, you know, George Carlin does, Pryor does, CK or DeChappelle, but that dude does not get the credit that he deserves. He's incredible.
I have something I want to ask you. So when I because, you know, I'm very professional at this, George. I'm a professional podcasting host now.
You're great at it.
Well, thank you. And it's just because I have a staff that provides me with information. And, you know, what's great is most folks I have on the show I know and have a relationship with, like you and I've run into each other in golf courses at baseball games and we're acquaintances. But every once in a while, the staff will find some shit in the – and I'm like, that's not true. George Lopez was not a witness in the trial of Michael Jackson.
Oh.
That's not true. Is it true?
Yeah. So – you know what? This is a great question. I'm going to tell you. So the Laugh Factory did these comedy camps. Jamie Masada at the Laugh Factory did these comedy camps with underprivileged people, with underprivileged kids.
Right.
So Chris Tucker did it. Jay Leno did it. Arsenio did it. A lot of guys did it. So I did it, and I get the Arvizos. I get Gavin, Star, Davelin, and the mother, Janet. And they lived up here. Like in Duarte, they took the bus over there, and I became their comedy coach. And I, you know, didn't know them. They were poor. I would take them to Greenblatt's next door, and I'd give them money for bus fare. I would buy them sandwiches. They'd take the bus back. And I was with them for about a month or so, 2 months. And then they did the show, and Gavin did the show. Gavin was pretty good. And then all of a sudden, I get a call from the mother, hysterical that Gavin is sick. And that they found a tumorous cancer tumor in his stomach, a pretty big tumor. He's at the hospital here on Sunset, the Children's Hospital. So I go over there, and I probably should say allegedly because it's going to get a little bit tricky right now, dicey. So I went over there, and because I'm going to show you something at the end. I went over there and was a friend. And then he needed blood, so we tried to do a blood drive for him. We did a show at the Laugh Factory to try to raise money, and I got him on Fox News to do a story about him. Fox. So Michael Jackson is allegedly watching Fox News and calls Fox to get the number of the kid, in the hospital, and he calls the hospital and starts talking to Gavin on the phone. I don't know, man. This is, it's tricky. Allegedly. So when I go over there, Gavin is like asleep during the day. And I said, so what's going on with Gavin? Like, why is he asleep? Oh, Michael called him. Michael Jackson called him. And I said, he did. About what? Oh, you know, he called me. They talked for like 5 hours, you know. And I said, 5 hours. So he would call him in the middle of the night, and allegedly they would talk. And, you know, he was at the point where he wasn't eating, but he was getting better, but he wasn't eating. But Michael was calling a lot. And, you know, they said to me, George, you know, tell him to eat. So I said to him, I said, Gavin, you know, if you eat, you get out of the hospital, and I'll take you, you know, I'll take you shopping. I'll take you to the store. We'll go have lunch. So he gets out, and I go pick him up, and he lives in Duarte. So I pick him up, and I bring him to my house in Sherman Oaks, and I take him to the Sherman Oaks Mall, and, you know, I buy him, I don't know what I buy him. I took him and my daughter, and then I bought him something. But when I take him home and I come back, my wife says, Gavin left his wallet on top of the mantle, which is odd. That, why would a kid put his wallet on the mantle? You know, whether he placed it there on purpose, whether however it got there, his wallet was there. And it was one of those wallets that, like, the surfers had, that had the Velcro. It closed.
Yeah, sure.
So I open it up. And I think at that point already, Gavin was going to the Neverland Ranch, allegedly, on the weekends. And Michael Jackson had was giving the father a truck to drive, allegedly, and the mother a credit card, allegedly, to go shop. And the kids were spending the weekend at Neverland Ranch. So, you know, alleged, of course. So I open the wallet, and there's a $50 bill in the wallet. And I think, how is this kid have a $50 bill in his wallet? And I show Ann, I said, Ann, this kid's got, I took this kid to lunch, got $50. So when I gave the wallet back to the Laugh Factory, gave it to Jamie, Jamie called the father. The father came and picked up the wallet, and the father said that there was $300 in the wallet and that I took the $300 from the wallet, that I took it. So when Tom Mesero was doing his vetting, allegedly, Jamie Masada says, well, you know, George Lopez took Gavin to lunch and they left his wallet. And then when he brought the wallet back, alleged, David Arvizo said that George Lopez stole $300 from the wallet. So Mesero thinks, okay, now I got somebody that looks like they're, you know, going after celebrities for financial gain. He used it in his opening argument. So I was in New York doing Regis and Kelly. And I wake up in the morning, and, you know, it's the biggest story. So I have Court TV on.
Jesus.
And right. I walk by, I get out of the shower, and I walk by the TV, and I look, and I go, God, that guy looks like me. I look over, and it is me. And it says, George Lopez is going to get subpoenaed, supposedly to testify in the Michael Jackson in trial. So I get a lawyer. Mesero calls me. He asked me if this thing is true.
Mesero is what? He's what? Michael's defense lawyer?
He's Michael Jackson. Tom Mesero is Michael Jackson's attorney.
Right.
So he says, this is true, you know. So what people don't know is when I was on the radio in 2000, I said that I would do a fundraiser for the family. So, but I canceled it because it became apparent to me that the father was more interested in the money than he was in having somebody, you know, help his child. Alleged.
Right.
So I did an appearance, and the father shows up and confronts me outside the restaurant and says, hey, motherfucker, you know, what's going on with this show? And I said, motherfucker. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, what am I supposed to tell Gavin? You know, all of a sudden you cancel the show. Like, what am I supposed to tell my kid? I said, tell your kid that his fucking dad's trying to fucking extort money for people, you know, instead of trying to worry about the kid. And he said, is that right? And he got in my face, and I said, yeah, that's right. So all of a sudden, here I am in this trial. I get subpoenaed. I'm doing my show. I hire an attorney. I rent a plane.
Jesus.
I fly to Santa Maria. Yeah. I get out and all that mayhem. I go into the courthouse. They're on a break. I get sworn. I'm standing around and I see the jury. I see Joseph Jackson. I see Catherine Jassy, the sisters alleged. Jeez. And then I'm looking for Michael Jackson. I don't see him. So I'm looking around and all of a sudden I see him. And he was dressed in, he looked like a nutcracker. Like he looked, he had a red jacket with the epaulets. He had the thing on.
Nutcracker.
And he had, I said he looked like the Captain and Tennille at the same time. Like he just was so done. Was so done up. And I wasn't for anybody's side. Like everybody thought, you know, I was for the side that it was true that, you know, that guy said I took $300. But while I was on the stand, Michael Jackson was looking at me. And I really didn't know Michael Jackson, but I mean, he looked just very, very, I don't know, man. I'm going to say, I hate to say it because I'm such a huge fan. Ghoulish, you know, very sunken, almost grayish. And I just, you know, was trying to smile at me and it bothered me, Rob, you know, for like 3 weeks after that, I wake up in the middle of the night and I would just think about him and, you know, growing up and that kid and the music and all this stuff. Yeah. But, you know, I wasn't on anybody's side. And I remember after I testified, the elevator was closing and him and his family was in there and he was in the middle. And they said, George, come on, get in the elevator. I said, no, I'm cool. I'm cool. He's right in the middle. The elevator door closes. But when the guy did the Living in Neverland, Martin Bashir, I was taping my show. And after we taped the show, I was watching the interview. And I had kind of forgotten about Gavin. And then as I'm watching the interview, he's sitting there on the couch holding hands with Michael Jackson. And it really was the first time I had seen him in months. And Rob, I jumped. I may have almost like hit my head on the ceiling. I was so like, what the? I mean, whoa, man, they're holding hands. They're leaning on each other. It's just like, oh my God.
Crazy.
So now I'm in this. Now I'm in this thing. And yeah, I testified in the trial. And as a matter of fact, here is the artist rendering.
No way. Look at that.
Of me on with Thomas Mesereau.
Oh, wait a minute, though. It looks like you're one of the Menendez brothers.
I know. They drew me. I asked the guy to be kind.
I think this is just a reject from the Menendez brothers trial.
But you see.
Look at that. There's Thomas Mesereau and there's, Michael. He is the captain and Tennille.
And there's Sneddon, the guy that really wanted him. The guy sitting down, the prosecutor. Yeah.
So by the way, that's the most unbelievable, like, what is it? What's the famous guy illustrator that everybody on Broadway gets done? You know, like the
Hirschfeld.
A Hirschfeld. Yeah. That's like the world's greatest Hirschfeld you just showed me.
So this guy is Bill Robles, and he is the Hirschfeld of court renderings.
That makes perfect sense. That's actually quite something.
And he was a big fan of mine, and he said, I'll send it to you. And it was on the news that night. So, yeah, man. And it cost me, here I try to help this kid, you know, Jamie Masada, you know, says, hey, you know, I said he took $300. It cost me $75,000 to defend myself or present myself at court.
Yeah, just present yourself, exactly.
Or something that I didn't do other than just try to help somebody.
That's such a crazy, crazy your life, brother.
That was wild, man. That was wild.
your life is too. We need to have stories when we play golf together. I need to come to Lakeside and
come to Lakeside and play, man. I'd love to see you out there.
So you know, we're getting back to it, and people need stuff to watch, man. You know, they need
sure.
We need, people need escapism. It's one of the reasons I love doing this show is it just gives it just a minute for people to just chill and You know, it's just, you know, nobody's haranguing anybody and we're, you know, talking thoughtful shit and funny stuff.
Right.
And that's the end of it. You know?
Yeah.
Or,
well, you know, you're good at it, man. So, yeah. So for me, you know, at 59, you know, with opportunities to do other stuff, you know, and, you know, did a Netflix special that came out and, you know, there'll be no stand up this year. Hmm. There won't be any shows. So I'm not sure that I'll go back and ever do stand up again. I may be done with that part of my career.
Wow.
You know, I just think I think the honor that it's given me, the things that it's given me, the Netflix thing was great. This kind of downtime has given me for the first time. I wasn't out there grinding as much, and in appreciation of something, you know, I think it might be time to put that kind of portion of my life away.
Go out on top, because it probably will never be what it was.
It won't be what it was. And, you know, I'm not sure if I want to travel as much. And, you know, at 59, you know, I had a kidney transplant in 2005. And you start to figure, you know, these days that I'm out there with my friends, and like, I like those days. I'm not sure if I want to be in a hotel room waiting for it to get dark, you know, anymore.
Well, when you put it that way, it sounds so great. George, you're the best. Thank you so much for coming on.
Absolutely, man.
And I am going to reach out to you and get your info, because
please.
Will you take me to Der Wiener Schnitzel?
It's not there anymore, but I'll take you where
it's not. No,
I'll take you to some great Mexican places though.
What is the one that's right by
Casa Vega? Lupo's over there yet?
Casa Vega, baby. Yeah.
You know, I went in there with Slash one time, and the waiters are still there, and the waiter goes, "Señor Slash. Remember when you used to come in here in the 80s, man, and it would be all dark and you'd come with some bit of Slash?" Like, nah, bro.
No, not the 80s.
What do you remember? I was Slash in the 80s going to remember, you know, having lunch in Casa Vega, and it was completely, completely dark. Like, all those guys went in there.
That's so good.
And drank all day and ate Mexican food.
Yep. Oh, yeah. I remember it well. Okay, so we'll do 18 holes in Casa Vega.
I love it, man.
Right. All right, brother. Love you, man. Thank you.
Absolutely,
thank you
so much. Thanks. Yeah, man.
Wow, that was amazing for me. I mean, I've known George peripherally for years and been a fan, but I had no idea the level of like self work and growth and how smart he is. I mean, I've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years in therapy. According to George, I could have listened to the baseball coach. Fuck. I mean, that was amazing. He is tuned up, man. He is an evolved human being. And in addition to being a 10 handicap, he may be the world's most perfect human being. And thank you for listening to Literally. And we'll see you again next week. And oh, by the way, don't forget to go. I'm reading all of the reviews and comments, by the way. It's for all of you people who've been kind enough to give me your thoughts and pointers, whether it's on Apple or Stitcher, or all the websites, particularly Apple. That's the one that gets the most traction. So if you've got an extra 5 minutes to spare, tell me what you think of the show. And I appreciate you. See you next week.
You have been listening to Literally with Rob Lowe. Produced and engineered by me, Devin Torrey Bryant. Executive produced by Rob Lowe for Low Profile. Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Stitcher. The supervising producer is Aaron Blaert. Talent producer, Jennifer Samples. Please rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Stitcher.